Hello, it's Friday, 2nd of July. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson. On this week's show, Gary Bowerman from Check In Asia and I will be reviewing the 6 top talking points in travel and tourism during June. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So on today's monthly review show, our new program, we'll rewind over the month of June and address 6 of the headline topics in travel and tourism across our region. Of course, we've got to include Phuket and Bali, but we've got 3 other less obvious issues as well. But I guess, Hannah, we have to start with the top story across the region throughout the last month, and that is the resurgence of COVID-19, and in particular, the worrying spread of the Delta variant.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is, Gary and I were just saying before we started, this is quite a frustrating time, I think, for many people in Southeast Asia. You know, last year, it looked like the region had a pretty good handle on it. There were just maybe a couple of outliers, Philippines and Indonesia. And now that halfway through 2021, everything has changed, hasn't it? Countries like Vietnam, who we never thought would be struggling with COVID, are still struggling to kind of stamp it out in Ho Chi Minh, have still had record case highs. It's tricky. And I think you've got some stats, right, Gary?
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting stats actually was, did the rounds on Twitter yesterday, it was published here in Malaysia, was that on the 1st of July 2020, Malaysia only actually had one new case of COVID-19. That's 1 year ago. And on the 1st of July this month, 6,988. I think that really shows a period where we thought, as you said, last year, that maybe some countries in the region had a handle on this for various reasons. Some of those are definitely government complacency. Some of those are the new Delta variant, which is definitely much more transmissible. That is just a stark polarization of where we were 1 year ago and where we are right now. We all turned into this year hoping that vaccinations were going to be the silver bullet and that, you know, by the middle of the year, things would probably be a lot better than we are. But we're 6 months into the year. And here in Malaysia in particular, we're looking at a speeding up vaccination rate, which is definitely accelerating. That is great news. But it's really not going to have much of an impact until the back end of this year, possibly early into 2022. And that's the situation of where we are right now. If we look at what's happened, as you mentioned, Hannah, we got some statistics across the month. Well, again, it doesn't make pretty reading. On the 1st of June, which is 1 month ago, there were 304,760 active cases in the 10 countries of ASEAN, 304,760. On the 1st of July, that number had rocketed to 457,000. In terms of the new daily cases, on the 1st of June, there were 20,275. On the 1st of July, 46,310. Now, those are the official figures. You know, there are rumors in some countries that the numbers are being underreported. But even if you just take the official figures, you know, the difference is pretty stark across 1 month.
It is. And like you say, Gary, the rate of vaccination is not really accelerating, perhaps at the rate that people wished it would. I mean, it is probably realistic, right? We know that Southeast Asia has faced vaccine supply shortages, and that perhaps is, I mean, you can argue that some of it was some governments not taking the initiative early last year to order, but also we've got vaccine hoarding and everything else that we've talked about in Western countries. But I mean, if we look at some of the rates of fully vaccinated populations, Indonesia is at 4.9, Malaysia's just over 7, Philippines 2.4, Thailand less than 4%, Vietnam 0.2%. And the only countries that are really making significant progress are Cambodia, which is now 18.24% fully vaccinated. And we've talked about this with Nick Ray, and this is pretty surprising, actually, that they have really pulled things out of the bag and somehow managed to vaccinate that bigger percentage of its population. And Singapore, I mean, in Singapore seems to have the vaccine supply in hand now, and they're saying that by 9th of August, 2/3 of its population are going to be fully vaccinated. So Singapore is light years away from any of the other countries in the region right now.
To a point, there is that that issue of just the size of the population. You know, for Indonesia, this is just a massive job. I mean, you look at the total number of vaccinations in Indonesia right now. There are 30.5 million people have received the first dose. 13.68 million have received 2 doses. Those are huge numbers. You add those together, and that's about 44 million people. But as a percentage of the population, it's still very, very low. So when you extrapolate into percentage figures, it really doesn't seem as though they're making huge progress. I think one of the other issues that definitely came to the fore across the past month, this sort of emanated from Singapore's approach that COVID-19 is going to be endemic. We have to live with it and we have to stop looking at new case infections per day. I'm still conflicted by that. I'm not sure that that's the right approach. I think you have to look at new cases, of course. You have to look at the active case rate. You have to look at hospitalizations. You have to look at the number of deaths. You have to be very nuanced about this. You have to use all the data sets. The argument is, of course, that most governments are only publishing the new cases in a way that is probably designed to scare the public into complying with the social distancing regulations that are still in place in most countries and the lockdowns. We've seen more lockdowns this month, and also to encourage more people to get a vaccine. So there is a purpose in using those figures. But I agree, we do need a much more nuanced look at those. But even if you look at the new case figures yesterday, there are 5 countries in our region that are reporting more than 1,000 cases per day. Indonesia is reporting nearly 25,000 cases per day, and that's the official rate. And Cambodia is only just below that. So Cambodia would be the 6th. They had 999 new cases yesterday. Vietnam, 545. And those two countries, I think, kind of exemplify some of the problems that we have, because Cambodia and Vietnam, if you go back several months, they were reporting single or double digit figures per day. And that just shows you the spread across the region. And it's going to be a long way out. As you say, the vaccination rates are accelerating, but from a really slow start, and still have the issues of supply. So we're far from out of the woods here.
So let's move on to the other big story of the month. And I don't think we will talk about this for too long, but I think we can't talk about June without talking about Phuket. Of course, today is the 2nd of July. So that means, we're talking about June review, but yes, Phuket Sandbox happened yesterday. It did open, which is exciting, right? It is the first area of Southeast Asia that is really opening up for leisure travelers in a tangible way. And I'm sure the rest of the region is going to be looking at that. So 347 passengers arrived yesterday from flights from Israel, the UAE, Qatar, and Singapore. But there's been plenty that's been going on in Thailand other than the Phuket Sandbox, right, Gary?
There has, but I think you're right. We do have to focus on that. Just going back to what you were saying there, these figures differ. I think you said, 347 there? I read that there were 323, so the actual total numbers are kind of mysterious. I think one of the issues that we've seen over June was, this whole project was so protracted and it went back and forth. It became a very, very politicized issue. Obviously, the key issue was getting the local residents vaccinated in Phuket. That was the absolute number one issue. But when it actually happens, and we've said this over and over, we spoke to David Lukens, who said this, this is really just the starting point. 1 July is really just the beginning, and this is going to build over the next 6 to 8 months if it's successful. But you look at the news agenda, and this was fueled by the Prime Minister of Thailand, who turns up on the first day for this photo shoot opportunity of welcoming the new planes. That just gives the wrong impression. That just kind of states that it was all about this first day, which I think is completely wrong. And you look at how some of the media around the world have reacted. And, I was looking at some of the headlines. So, for example, there are two that I picked out that really, really focus on the COVID issue as well as the Phuket issue. So, for example, Nikkei Asia said, Thailand sets daily death record as tourists return. ABC News Australia went even harder, said coronavirus is raging in Thailand, but Phuket has set itself up as a fortress for vaccinated tourists. There's a lot of editorializing in those. But then you look elsewhere and people are actually looking at the story a little bit more in terms of its nuances. CNN Travel, for example, said Thailand's most popular island, Phuket, reopens to vaccinated international travelers. That's very factual. Straits Times in Singapore said Phuket opens for business in a push to save its vital tourism industry. Again, that's quite factual. And Reuters says Thailand's paradise island, Phuket, reopens to tourists. So, different media are reinterpreting this in different ways. And it'll be interesting to see how long this stays on the global sort of media cycle, because they tend to move on quite quickly. If it's successful, then you probably won't hear much about it at all. But as we've seen with the Australia and New Zealand travel bubble, as soon as it hits the rocks and things have to pause or whatever, then that becomes a news story again. from everybody's point of view in this region, we hope it stays out of the news for July, August, September, October, and through the rest of the year.
Absolutely. And although some of those news stories were, you know, kind of sensationalizing the COVID numbers being very high at the same time as opening for Phuket, I think it is a valid point. Yes, Phuket has reopened, but areas such as Bangkok, some of the neighboring provinces, some of the southernmost provinces in Thailand that border with Malaysia, have been put under a stricter lockdown. And they had only had lockdown measures eased for about a week or so before this has happened. Dine-in is banned again. And it must be very strange to be in Thailand right now, I think, with all of this focus on trying to let vaccinated travelers in, and at the same time your country is struggling to cope, to get COVID-19 back under control.
Yeah, this is the entire paradox of this sort of ghettoized version of tourism, isn't it? If you open up one of your islands, you try to make it safe, but the rest of your country isn't. How does that reflect on the country as a whole? But then again, if you look at European countries that open up the countries as a whole, and you can travel to any parts of them, you know, numbers are starting to rise again, as they did last summer, even though vaccination rates in Europe are pretty high. So too are the new case rates because of this Delta variant. There is no simple solution to this. And, you know, Phuket, I think, is going to find that, you know, there is some resentment in the rest of Thailand about this specialized treatment that it's got. But what was the other option? You know, you can reintroduce tourism in safe zones, or you don't reintroduce it at all. I wouldn't want to be in government right now, would you?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I guess the overarching goal should really be to be able to drive cases down, to be able to stimulate domestic tourism, to at least get that going again. And even this, I mean, Thailand has had quite a few different domestic stimulus packages or different phases of this one called Tortio Thai, which is Thais travel to Thailand. But the tourism minister is now saying, you know, they're in talks with the TAT to see actually whether they're going to even restart this stimulus package at all, because they feel that it perhaps doesn't benefit the entire tourism industry, which I think is fairly true. So that there was an article in the Bangkok Post saying that tour buses in particular were losing out, and, you know, tourism ministry threatening that if it doesn't benefit everybody, perhaps they will just cut it altogether. I mean, I'm not sure that that is the right solution either. I think there are certainly a lot of Thai tour operators and hotels who are relying on this scheme to get them through and generate revenue last year. But really, now they've opened up Phuket, I think the focus has to be on how do we revive domestic tourism again once people are comfortable with the idea of being able to travel around Thailand domestically again.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think that should be the focus, but it simply won't be. You know, if this is successful, it's going to be, they've already said, haven't they, the Thai government and the Tourism Authority of Thailand, the strategy now is to reopen in phase way, particularly through October towards the end of the year, other destinations as well, if this goes successfully. That, of course, depends on the vaccination rates and the case number rates in those other destinations. It's a very complex picture. And yeah, in those terms, we haven't yet heard the end of this story by any means, I think.
No. So should we hop over to another Southeast Asian country now?
Let's move on.
And of course, we also spent a lot of June talking about Bali, didn't we, Gary? We talked about Bali with Stuart McDonald, and we had the Bali Hotels Association on the show as well. And of course, everybody was talking about this idea of Bali reopening to tourism in July. Obviously, we're on the 2nd of July. And like you said, Gary, yesterday, Indonesia reported almost 25,000 cases. Cases are really spiking there. They're spiking very, very fast. And from tomorrow, so again, technically not June news, but hey, we're in July already. From tomorrow, they are implementing almost a lockdown. I mean, Indonesia has never really gone full hard lockdown, but this is quite close to it in Jakarta, in Java province, in Bali as well. And Indonesia's coordinating minister for maritime affairs and investment said in a press conference, there's no way we can reopen with this Delta variant, so we're not even thinking about that right now. Right now, we're thinking about how to scale down the crisis. It seems like those Bali dreams that we had in June might not come to fruition in July.
Possibly get kicked back. Maybe towards the back end of the year, maybe into 2022. The situation is so serious in Indonesia right now. It's interesting, isn't it? Because this shows you just how things change over a period of time. When you and I were talking back in, I think it was March, April, we were talking with Brett Henry on the MG Group podcast, and we were talking about Bali and Phuket. And we both said that we thought Bali had more chances of happening than Phuket. And then it turns around completely the other way. They've cancelled all their tourism promotion programs. The Work from Bali campaign has been put on hold. They're also looking at doing vaccinated tourism for not just for inbound travelers, but also for domestic travelers. That looks like that's on hold. It really looks like Indonesia has to focus on one thing and one thing only, and that's getting down the numbers of daily cases and particularly the hospitalizations, because I think hospitals, particularly in cities like Jakarta, are just struggling to cope.
Yeah, I think earlier in the week, hospital occupancy in Jakarta was at 93%, and there's certainly been lots of, I think, photos going around on social media, you know, tents being erected outside and things. So like you say, Gary, it's absolutely serious, and I think we all remember what happened in India a couple of months ago, and, you know, Indonesia's got a big enough population that this kind of thing could happen. And I guess the big question surrounding this also is the Sinovac vaccine, right? Because, of course, Indonesia has mainly been relying on the Sinovac vaccine for the majority of the jabs. And there's been lots of reports of frontliner staff who have been vaccinated with Sinovac now contracting the virus too. How effective is this versus the Delta? I think that's going to be a whole other question that's going to continue on in July.
Yeah, and I think the two other issues I thought that have come out of this that are both worrying. One is obviously what happened in India with the scale of that outbreak, the scale across the nation and the number of daily infections was that's how the Delta variant emerged. You know, Indonesia has a huge population. There is a real worry that a different variant could emerge, which would be just devastating for the country and for the region as well. The other issue I thought that was quite interesting was that, you know, we've been talking over and over in recent months about innovations in testing procedures, and Indonesia has reverted back to PCR and antigen swab tests. It had this Genos innovation, which was a breath test, and it's now decided that just simply doesn't work effectively enough. So again, you know, we move forward, we move backwards. And, you know, we wish everybody in Indonesia extremely well, because this is a very worrying situation for them. The government has recognized that. And, you know, priority number one now is looking after the public. So let's move on to our fourth point. And this is kind of related and kind of not related. And I touched on this earlier, is whether Southeast Asia's current reopening strategies are simply too stringent. Now, they are being made stringent, of course, because governments have been cautious over the past year and a half. The economic reality is starting to bite, absolutely. That's why Thailand has reopened or partially reopened in Phuket. But then you look at what's happening in the rest of the world, and Europe in particular, in North America, they're looking very much at just trying to reboot tourism. Australia, New Zealand are going the other way. It's winter there, of course, so, you know, it's a dangerous time for those countries. But, you know, what do you think about this, Hannah? You know, that one of the problems, and we talked about this over and over during June with Phuket, is that simply they couldn't get an agreement on what the process has had to be. That even now, if you do sign up for the Phuket sandbox, you have to have 5 official documentations, including $100,000 on your medical insurance. Do you think it's too stringent? Do you think it just reflects the times? But does this actually move tourism forward, or is this just not the time to be moving tourism forward?
Yes, the big question, isn't it? It's a great question. I mean, yes, if you compare right now, if you were a traveler from, let's say, the UAE, and you were weighing up, do I go to Phuket or do I go to Europe? And you look at all of the different travel requirements, it's a bit of a no-brainer, right? I think you would choose to go to Europe, because they don't have as many of all of these hoops that you've got to jump through. But are we going to see the benefits of this in a few months' time? It feels almost a bit like deja vu. You know, last year, again, Europe threw open the borders on summertime and autumn and winter. They came to really regret that. Are we going to see that happen in a couple of months' time again? Maybe. So, yes, you know, Asia is cautious, and we've talked about that, and Southeast Asia, incredibly cautious. But like you say, it does have to open up in some way. And I think that the residents here are also a lot more cautious. You know, when you look at surveys about their fear of COVID, fear levels in general are a lot higher in Southeast Asia. So the governments have not only got to manage the risk of the virus, but they've also got to manage their people's perceptions of risk as well. And of course, you don't want to go and upset everybody by throwing the country completely open and the political repercussions that could follow from that if cases do spike up. So it's a really delicate balance. I mean, I think certainly there are things that could be a lot easier about Phuket Sandbox. But as we keep saying, you know, nobody's gone through this before. Everybody is trying to figure it out on the fly. And there are inevitably going to be things that come up. So the only kind of hope for this is that, yes, Phuket Sandbox works. They gradually kind of ease off requirements a little bit. And as they do that, other Southeast Asian countries look to it as this kind of case study and learn what not to do when they open up their own countries. What do you think?
Well, you made an interesting point there when you were talking about Indonesia and the Chinese vaccines. And as we were talking to Nick Ray, Cambodia has this idea to kind of watch and wait a little bit. It definitely wants to reopen, perhaps to see them react, maybe other parts of the country as well, maybe in November or December, certainly at the back end of the year. But again, you know, Cambodia is using the Chinese vaccines exclusively at the moment. So, you know, what will that mean? There is a real argument that second mover advantage could benefit here. You know, if you open too soon, you do open the doors to the virus coming back. You do open the doors to the variant. But as you also said, countries have got to reopen at some point. Even if that's in 2022, there will still be risks of doing that. It's absolutely how they manage the processes and protocols, but that doesn't make tourism attractive. And as you said, it's being done on the fly. It's a very, very difficult thing for governments to manage right now. I thought it was an interesting point that Dr. Jaeyon Che mentioned in our podcast earlier this week about South Korean travelers who are this summer heading to Europe. Now, that's quite an interesting concept, really, because you assume generally that South Koreans will be, you know, quite reticent to not just to travel, but careful in terms of security and safety and personal health. They're going to Europe this summer because they feel that Europe, you've got more chance to travel out into the countryside, away from the cities. You can enjoy more experiences. Whereas if you come to Phuket or Bali at the moment, you are going to be kind of pigeonholed in certain parts of those islands. But she did say that, you know, Phuket and Bali just aren't really making much waves in terms of news in South Korea right now. And that she really didn't see that there would be many bookings. That may be generally because South Koreans don't tend to go to those two destinations. She mentioned Vietnam and Philippines, destinations that South Koreans are really looking to once they reopen. So, you know, we're going to have to look at how different destinations are going to attract different markets. Phuket is really looking at the moment to Europe, Middle East, Israel as well. This will evolve over time, I guess. We're really at the early stages. And some countries which still have their doors locked, Malaysia is a very good example there, I guess we'll also be watching and waiting. But it's a very piecemeal picture, isn't it, right now?
Yeah, it is. And actually, I just remembered from when we were talking to Dr. Jaeyon, quite interesting because I think she had the misperception, and I think a lot of Korean tourists must also have that misperception, that you have to stay in Phuket for 2 weeks. So I think that there is also this issue of there are lots of requirements that are not necessarily being communicated in the clearest way, in the most attractive way to these source markets too. So, you know, in terms of that kind of PR and getting the information out there, something is still missing, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that is because Thailand, the Tourism Authority of Thailand in particular, tried to square too many circles at once. I think what we're going to be seeing, certainly in the initial phase, is people flying in, having their holiday in Phuket and flying out again. You know, it's simply going to be charter trips in, out. But the Tourism Authority of Thailand wanted to open the doors to other travel into the rest of Thailand, didn't they? So they sort of put this 14-day window on that you have to stay on Phuket before you can travel elsewhere. I think they should have introduced that later. I think they should have just focused their messaging, come to Phuket and then leave again, enjoy your holiday and go home. Traveling into the rest of Thailand at the moment with the situation as it is just seems a little bit too premature.
Yeah, I mean, especially given the current situation, I don't think it would be particularly attractive, let's say, to make a visit to Bangkok right now. So another interesting point that came up during June was education tourism. We saw Singapore and Australia talking about a travel bubble, an air travel bubble between the two of them. So far, so samey, right? We've heard that. But what was kind of interesting about this conversation between the two prime ministers was that they were talking more specifically about allowing Singaporean students to return to Australia for their studies. Of course, Australia has a really big market for students. We've talked about that with Simon Westaway on the show earlier in the year as well, about how Australia is quite reliant on this foreign student market. And so it was interesting. It wasn't specifically about leisure, but they were talking about starting off with students, Singaporean students coming to Australia and then kind of expanding that out. But with this resurgence of cases in Australia, it kind of looks unlikely to come off in the short term, I think.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I think the two prime ministers met, what was that? I think it was on the 10th of June in Singapore. And that was when Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison was on his way to the UK for the G7 meeting. They said that they wanted to create this travel bubble between the two countries for more general travel, but they would pilot it for education travel. It's a multi-billion dollar industry for Australia. And the other aspect of that I thought was interesting. Now, there's the travel side to it. So you have students that go into Australia, they stay there, they spend money. There's a lot of visiting friends and relatives that come and visit them in Australia while they're studying there. But one of the Australian ministers made a very interesting point as well, that actually a lot of Australian jobs rely on that industry. So it's not just about the travel, it's about the education sector and those travel and retail and all the other businesses that rely on international students in Australia. It shows you just how wide and encompassing the tourism economy is. That was a really interesting point. But again, you know, this is almost a month ago now that this was discussed. I think the West Australian newspaper reported last week, and it quoted Singapore Airlines saying that the travel bubble discussions between the two countries, Singapore and Australia, haven't even commenced yet. As you said, Australia is going through a particularly difficult situation. There's huge controversy in Australia at the moment about the slowness of the vaccination rollout and the fact that it relied initially on AstraZeneca, then decided it didn't want to use AstraZeneca, then U-turned. There's a horrible political situation emerging there, and it is winter as well. So it's a dangerous time in terms of viruses in general, not just the coronavirus. So this one looks like it's going to be kicked back into the future. But it also raises this issue of education, not just tourism, but education travel. I think we had here in Malaysia, Malaysian students were being prioritized, or they were asked to apply for vaccinations so that they may be able to travel overseas. The UK last week held a big convention in a way to try and find ways that Chinese students could come back into the country. There's huge numbers of Chinese study each year in the UK. So it is a bigger issue, and it's something that, you know, it affects travel, it affects tourism, but it affects education. It affects the future lives of these young people that, you know, they're having to study online at the moment. They're not getting the benefits of in-person tuition and all the things that come with studying in an overseas country. And, you know, that's been put on hold for so long now. There doesn't really seem to be any reason why vaccinated students shouldn't be welcomed back into countries. But of course, as we've said before, on all these issues, there's just so little integration and cooperation between countries that it's just been proving so difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of parents will also be concerned about sending their children so far away overseas as well. So that's going to play into the confidence about rebooting student travel too.
Absolutely agree with that. But at least it's on the agenda, and hopefully it will get discussed as vaccination rates roll out. I think that's the most important point.
And so on to our last talking point, which is kind of Southeast Asia, but kind of not, right?
Yeah, kind of Southeast Asia, but not. So it's basically Malaysia-based Genting Corporation, which has opened its new Resorts World Las Vegas on the Strip in Las Vegas. We spoke to Bill Healy, who was based in Las Vegas a few weeks ago, and he said that the Las Vegas casino travel economy is starting to get quite buoyant again. He said that the weekend before we spoke to him that their numbers were really up. More people are coming. Now, it's very much a domestic, at the moment, it's a domestic US-based market, but, you know, Las Vegas is a very, very popular destination. So Resorts World Las Vegas is about to open. It's a US $4.3 billion investment, 88 acres worth on the north end of the Strip. So it's not in the center of the Strip, so it's not actually accessible by walking. You have to take a taxi there. But it's huge, and it's very tech-focused. So it's 3,500 guest rooms, 117,000 square feet of cashless casinos, which is quite interesting. It has a 5,000-seat theater so that you can have all the entertainment that goes with, you know, and Ritz and glamour that goes with Las Vegas. But it doesn't have any convention facilities at the moment. But the interesting aspect of this one, I think, is that a tunnel is being created by Elon Musk's Boring Co., which eventually will ferry guests to the nearby Las Vegas Convention Center, which is too far to walk, but then that offers opportunities for the midweek convention market, which is so important for Vegas. Is this a major development for Southeast Asian tourism? Well, it's a major Southeast Asian player. Genting opens its first casino here in Malaysia. It also has Resorts World in Singapore on Sentosa Island, has a casino world, a Resorts World in Manila as well. Also has operations in New York, Bahamas, Birmingham in the UK, and it's leading a consortium for when Japan opens to casino tourism. It's looking like it may get one of the franchises in Yokohama. It's also been trying to get into Miami for several years. It's really looking at the US market. So Genting is still looking at this, even though its operations here in Southeast Asia have had so much troubles over recent months. And another interesting aspect, a side aspect to Genting, is that Malaysia yesterday closed applications for the new digital bank licenses, which will be issued next year. 5 licenses will be issued. Over 50 companies, including traditional banks, but also other companies, have applied for a digital bank license. Those include Genting. They also include Grab, who's in a consortium with Singtel. Air Asia's BigPay is also applying. China's Tencent and Petronas, the national petroleum company here. Now, the interesting thing about that is not so much the digital banking, which is an entirely different issue. Singapore and Philippines have already started issuing their first licenses. But the fact that some of these big companies, including players in the travel industry, are so interested in Malaysia digital licenses shows that they do have confidence in future in Malaysia's consumer economy and perhaps its tourism economy too. So although the situation looks pretty bleak at the moment, this does suggest in future there'll be huge investments in these products. And it bodes well for an economic recovery down the line.
Yeah, it certainly does, which is a good way, I think, to end this week's show, looking back on, at least on a slightly more positive note than COVID cases surging everywhere. We hope you enjoyed this week's podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we discussed or what we missed out. You can drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yep. Meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us, as that helps other people to find the show. And just before we go, we actually put up a list on our LinkedIn page yesterday of our top 10 podcasts through June. This is our June review show. The number one show was our interview on the Bali reopening with Stuart McDonald, but several other interviews also hit the top 10. So please do have a look at that. We'll put a link on the show notes.
Yep, go check out the back catalogue. And that's a wrap for this week. We'll be back next Wednesday with Singapore-based aviation analyst Brendan Sobey as our guest. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.